Welcome to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. I'm here once again with Noel. Hi, Noel. Welcome.
Hi.
For those that are listening for the first time, the podcast shines a light on the bands of the 80s that perhaps have been forgotten or haven't had the profile that we believe they should have done. So today, Noel, we're talking about Fisher Z. Great news about today, Noel, is that we're also going to be talking to John Watts from Fisher Z later on in the podcast. So
cool. Yeah,
can't wait for that. So what do you know about Fisher Z, Noel?
Well, what I know about Fisher Z is not a lot, to be honest with you. They first came on my radar, not because I ever heard anything, but because when I used to go to record fairs and I'd go through the F box looking for Faith Brothers records, there was always a Fisher Z record in there. So that's how I first saw the name.
Ah, okay. Mine is a bit different. When Nine Below Zero split up in, I think it was probably 82, maybe something like that, we went to see The Truth's first ever concert, and we met some other fans of Nine Below Zero, but they were huge Fisher Z fans.
Right.
I'd never heard of Fisher Z, so you know, for me it was like, well, who are these and what's this weird name, you know? It was such a strange, you know, strange name. So for me, they were a band that I've, you know, as I say, I'd never heard, but then started to listen to them and just sort of really started to really like them. And then I went to see them a few times over the years.
So who's in the band then, Martin?
Well, so the original lineup was John Watts, vocal and guitar, Steve Skolnick, who actually formed the band with John Watts.
Oh, right, joint founder, yeah.
Yeah, and they were sort of working in psychiatric clinics and clinical psychology at the time.
So that was a day job, yeah?
That was their sort of day job, yeah.
Yeah.
And so Steve Skolnick on keyboards, Dave Graham on bass, and Steve Little on the drums.
All right, four-piece, yeah.
John Watts has had, you know, sold lots of albums, 22 albums. They've sold...
22
wow. Albums, their sales are excess of 2 million, and they've played to huge, huge numbers, particularly in Europe, and they've toured with The Police, Dire Straits.
See that they played a gig in East Berlin to 167,000 people?
167,000.
Well, that's amazing.
And then, Matt, they are massive in Germany. I actually went to see them in Berlin, Columbia Theatre. So Fisher Z were around in sort of late, in 76, 77. They're still about punk era. Punk era, but they've had a number of iterations, I would say, over that time period, both from the band themselves into another band called The Cry, as well as John Watts solo, and then the sort of Fisher Z brand, I guess. And they made three albums initially, which are probably theirs, you know, what some of those albums you probably see at record fairs, which is like Word Salad, Going Deaf for a Living, and Red Skies Over Paradise. But like 2017 was like their 40th anniversary as a band. So you can see that they've been around. But if you go right back to their early days, our good old friend John Peel comes into the story as always.
Yes.
So just like he played all of the, you know, TV21 album, he played Remember Russia, which is one of their first singles.
Thank you.
Remember Russia didn't quite chart. It was sort of like the precursor to John Peel sort of championing the band a
Yeah,
lot.
so it really raised a profile for them then, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously that, you know, they then got a little bit of profile on the Old Grey Whistle Test,
Oh, wow.
and The Worker was their sort of, you call it their hit, but it sort of got to like number 53 in the UK and charted better in Europe. Another song called So Long, whilst in the UK got to like number 72, in Europe it started to get in the top 20. In Portugal it got in the top five, you know,
Wow.
so they started to get more profile there, and that's where they seem to have a lot of their success. You know, they played a lot of shows between 80 and 81, for example.
Is that the era when they had their video played on MTV?
Yes, that was, yeah, So Long was on MTV, and also Marlies, I think, as well, because that Marlies was the single from Red Skies Over Paradise that was actually got to number one in Portugal.
Take photos for this magazine. They let me in to see you comb your hair. I watched the sign as I came through that door. The anxious eyes that I've been waiting for. No use hoping I'm a dream. Oh, Marlies. Oh, my name.
that would be interesting to ask John about the fact that they, you know, being a sort of UK-based band, that their success wasn't in the UK or was limited in the UK, but the rest of Europe was were massive, you know. But I mean, I guess the MTV might have been an influence on that.
But what was interesting is that despite all that, it's sort of back end of 81, they sort of, John Watts decided to break them up because he felt the band had become perhaps too far away from their original punk sort of ideals, you know.
Well, that's interesting because I've heard some of the stuff after that, and it sounds to me a little like the kind of John Fox, Ultra Fox, very early kind of like synth sound. I suppose the point I'm making is it doesn't sound the punk thing that he was trying to keep up.
It's a definite difference between those albums that he released post Red Skies Over Paradise, for example. So, you know, he released a couple of solo albums, One More Twist and The Iceberg Model. He also then created another band called The Cry, which sort of had an album called Quick, Quick, Slow. And that was almost in that sort of very poppy type feel.
Fantastic.
So that was very different.
Do they do any gigs? Do they gig a lot?
Yeah, I mean, they did a lot of gigs in that first iteration, you know, sort of like a couple of hundred of them between 80 and 81. And they supported like the Police and Dire Straits, as well as, and they actually appeared on the sort of Bob Marley's final European sort of festival tour.
Wow.
So they appeared on that bill.
Yeah, and I guess playing the Bob Marley thing, and I'm assuming some of these other gigs were in Europe as well, that must have raised their profile, you know, which must have helped with them. You know,
well, certainly, I know if you know, there's a lot of clips of them at a lot of those European festivals.
Right,
So, you know, like Pink Pop. I mean, I won't go through all of the albums they released because there's a lot of them, but, you know, there's some key moments, I guess, as John has taken the band in so many iterations from the band Fisher's Ed through to The Cry, through to his solo career, and then back to his solo career, and then back to Fisher's Ed. Pretty much all the songs and all the albums, they, even a John Watts album, you can tell has got that sort of sound, because that is his sound, you know. Post late 80s, early 90s, they only really had sort of one song, Will You Be There?
They told me today, oh, I never thought they would dispose of me. Out of the blue, they told me the news. I took my calm and my patience, and I told them what to do. I'm going out.
I'm going out.
I'm coming back again.
I'm coming back again.
Will you be there?
Will you be there?
By my side. Outside the gates, the feelings ran high, oh, they all were waiting for an explanation. In the end, a spokesman appeared and read a tight, written statement for the journalist to hear. I'm going out.
That got to like number 95 in Germany. And then the sort of chart success seems to have, not that music is about chart success, of course, but obviously, you know, whatever they've done, they've made an income, you know, and they made a career out of playing live. Just finishing off then on reunions, 2004, he did a reunion of the original band for like a show. And it was sort of released as part of a sort of Fisher's Ed highlights package as a 25th compilation album. So that was quite nice to see all those original guys back together. Post that anniversary, the 25th anniversary concert, they then started to, you know, he was still making albums. It got to the 40th anniversary in 2017, still made albums, building bridges. Obviously the pandemic, as it has done with all the bands that we've spoken to that are still going, put everything on sort of hold. But what's interesting about the pandemic is they created an album, as a lot of bands did in lockdown, called Till the Oceans Overflow. And that is, I'm not sure whether you'd call it a follow-up or a companion album to Red Skies Over Paradise. So if you look at the two covers, they are different colors, but very similar pictures. So
they're still gigging now?
still gigging now,
Yeah.
still making albums. You know, they were just they're still doing dates. They do the odd date in the UK. It's few and far between. But in, as I say, in Europe, they are they have a regular touring schedule. So let's have a chat with John.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Very interesting.
All right. Well, welcome, John, to the Uncharted 80s podcast. Great to have you
Thank you.
here. We wanted to sort of perhaps start off by going back a little bit about some of your earlier influences before you sort of started off Fisher Z.
Yeah. My hero was George Melly. So I was the only person under 40. I should go when I was 15, 16. You came up to me once and just said, "Dear boy, why have you come to see my show?" And I said, "Because you're a showman. I liked his suit. I'm a big fan of the music hall. I got relatives who were in the music hall before the war, or the Second World War. I just thought he was such an outrageous performer. I like Bowie stuff because he changed all the time. I like the people who were poetic and essentially, I've never been a big rock fan. So the idea of people, writers, you know, the Dylans and the Leonard Cohens and people that could actually write, I like that. So as a word, more interested in politics than music in many ways, and more of a writer than a songwriter.
With those influences then, when did you realise then that a sort of career in music was possible? Was there like an event or a moment?
From the age of 11, I told them I'd love to be a pop star. I'd play cricket for England, and they didn't believe me. I told them that when I was 11. I told them that when I was 16. I told them that when I was 18. And then I'm a clinical psychologist. I studied psychopaths mainly, and I did 4.5 years of clinical psychology because that course was a sandwich course, which meant I got paid. So I was like working in mental hospitals from 7 in the morning till about 4, and then chasing the van to wherever they went, like to Birmingham or somewhere, catch up with a van in London, come back at 3 in the morning and get up again and work in hospitals. So my
Wow.
background was totally different to most of the other bozos. They've been around London, they've been in clubs, like a lot of the so-called new wave lot. I mean, obviously in Ian Dury and everybody, the Stranglers, they'd all been on the circuits. I haven't been. They've been in London circuits. They played the clubs. When there was the club lot, like Rugalate, the Feel Goods, obviously, who I knew from being signed to UA, they came from an R&B background. You know, all the clubs in London, like the Dingwallses and the Nashvilles, they'd all been playing them for ages. Like Joe Strummer had been knocking about in different bands, and they mutated and picked up the zeitgeist. I came straight from mental hospitals, straight in, and we weren't ranting about Thatcher. I was interested in my dad was a politician, and also he was a military historian, and so I come from a totally family of soldiers, and so the background's just totally different. And when we came in, I didn't understand. I never went to. I mean, if I'd have known what art college was, I'd have gone to it. But people like where I came from didn't go to art college. Art college, which is where most of the band seemed to come from. I mean, I know, for instance, Elvis Costello, Annie Lennox, and Joe Jackson were all in the same music school class in London, studying composition and all that kind of stuff. I was just trying to avoid being attacked with broken glass by ex-commandos that used to be security guards for Arab princes.
Wow.
A different background.
I guess the ability to spot a sociopath would have helped when you met a few A&R men as well.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. We saw ourselves, which it wasn't defined. We were art punks in as much as we were from the kind of more to do with the art world and more to do with performance, like XTC, my boys, XTC, Talking Heads, bands that came from that kind of a background. It was still they, but like, I mean, actually, Talking Heads were art school, but some of the others again, but they'd been knocking around for years as well. So yeah,
Yeah.
but so it wasn't the same. It wasn't the same background at all.
Great
So when you
song.
started Fisher Z, obviously we know it's based on a pun, the name, you know,
Yeah,
Fisher Z.
yeah.
So did
No,
you,
it's
how did you
not. No. It's
not?
based. No, nothing to do with that. During the psychology study, if you get a n norm, when you're studying normal data, you get a symmetrical curve of data.
Right.
If you're studying something that's skewed, you do an F test because it's a bent and twisted and weird distribution, and that's a Fisher Z distribution. And so
Oh,
I wanted to
right.
take a name that meant nothing, because I was studying Lacan, the philosopher, and the whole point there was that the signifier and the signified. I mean, this thing is yellow metal thing. It's in fact a capo.
Yeah.
So the signifier is the yellow metal thing, and the name's the capo. And so I thought that if we had a name Fisher Z, nobody knew what it was. It would never date. It would never be like anybody else's name. And when people heard the name, they'd think of my voice and the sound. And it's been the absolute bugbear because that's exactly what happened. So if you try to move outside the thing you first do, people find it difficult to follow. And I've been
Right.
Fisher Z. I've been six different names. I mean, if you've managed to follow my career, you've done very well.
I have, yeah. So I've been there, John,
You need
right
an
from
award. You need an award, mate.
I've been there through the cry, through J.M. Watts, through,
Para Music. Did you buy the Big Beat Poetry record?
I did, and I've also got...
Well, if you got that, that's really unusual. People don't even know who that is. Do you know that got awards of all sorts? We did them limited 5,000 vinyls, 5,000 CDs.
Yeah, I got that one as well.
Oh, you got that one? Yeah. Oh, that was designed by Ingo. He's a great designer. I mean, the DJ who worked with me, design genius.
That Big Beat Poetry, I mean, that is quite rare, I have to say.
Yes, it certainly is. It's amazing. I've never seen one in England. It's very unusual because our thing in England is so culty. I mean, I've done 25 albums, at least, I think, or maybe 26 albums.
Yeah.
What's interesting is when people have the mailing list and they write to us, there's far more English people than you'd expect. You'd expect the majority, you'd expect there's more English people write to us than Germans.
Right.
Which is ridiculous if you compare it with the sale. But the thing is, I obviously left it at a point it was just to go out to get huge in Britain because everything was teed up for Marlies and Nightingale, all the Radio 1 people, and I left it. Before that, I was going mad because we'd just been worked much, much, much too hard. A common sense, and I've got a certain neurodiversity, which means I just ditch things completely, stupidly in a way. I mean, my business history is a litany of disasters. But the idea of, most people would just stop and have a rest and didn't. I just walked away from it. I decided to do it the night before and announced it on stage to everybody's great surprise and left it. I mean, Britain was just about, I mean, people were very pissed off because the media people, because we did the European tour first, the Red Skies tour. I mean, you're in a situation, it's very weird compared to the record business now. I mean, the Fisher's Ed, Red Skies in Germany was selling 50,000 a week. So that was going crazy. We were all set up to go back to England. I just didn't want to do it. My ears were shot. There's nothing wrong. I didn't lose my hearing, but I just got fed up with it. And I did everything. I produced it. I sung it. I did all the promo. The other people in the band had a great time. They, when they're in the studio, they're in the swimming pool and on the go-karts, and I was mixing and producing the record. And on the road, they just had to get there in the afternoon and do a sound check and have a nice meal. And I was off from 7 in the morning doing breakfast radios for 2 hours, then the morning radios, shaking hands with all record dealers, going and seeing the record company personnel, meeting people, get to a sound check, probably back out again, come to do the show. I'm sometimes eating a bit of steak and going on stage at the same time. Come off, then you go off. You're off to talk to dealers again. You're roped off in cocktail bars. It's crazy.
Wow.
So that European, you obviously you're huge, huge in Europe. Yeah. What do you put it down to? Why did they seem to get you in the band as opposed to like the UK audience?
Well, we never gave the UK a chance. My manager was my school friend. The big problem was this: we it took off so fast in Europe, like the Police did and like Dire Straits did. We worked there, but we didn't come back and do the Brit. We were about to do the consult. We were cult, as you know. We started by going around the universities. We did the tours in 79. We had a very good cult name. We did Whistle Test twice, which gave us a very good name. We did the Worker on Top of the Pots, which was dreadful because it was so squeaky. I mean, I was described as a monkey on helium. I do the Worker song still, but not that high. It was ready to go, but I left it. Simple as that. So we'd have consolidated. Remember, we were bigger than the U2s and the Simple Minds and everything at that stage. But it's just not, I'm not a great rock and roll person. And I wasn't feeling it. The irony is I've missed out on a lot of stuff in one way. But on the other hand, I did that. I then did the John Watts album immediately. If that would have been a Fisher's Ed record, it'd have sold a million records. And things like, if you know tracks like One Voice. People think that's a Fisher's Ed song, but it's not. It was a solo song. Then we did the Iceberg Model, which got great reviews for being a very which it was, a very interesting album. Then I did The Cry. Then I stopped for 2 or 3 years, and 3 years from actually touring, and had 3 kids. So I did have a chance to see my children and see them grow up. I did all that. I don't think I'd have done that otherwise. I think if I'd have kept going on the same route as the rest of them, I'd have probably got into politics by the time I was 45 or making films. But as it is, I might make music.
So do you regret anything about the decisions you made then?
Oh, yeah. I would always say I'm not a regretting person personally, but when I look at it now, I think that I'm nearly 70 now. The idea, the opportunities, my automatic response, I was a very good cricketer. If you're batting, when you hit the ball, if you think you're definitely safe, you say yes. And if it's definitely not, you say no. But it's not normally the case. It's usually 70% of the time you say wait. And that's what I could never do when I was younger. And I didn't understand the way a brain worked then. And so when I say I regret, I mean, don't know. I mean, the point is, it's the career I've got now, I'm delighted with. The number of people that are doing what I'm doing, if I still feel that at a different age, I'm still on the top of my game. And I can't say that about many of my contemporaries, especially the ones that are dead. At least a third of them are dead. Wow. At least another third of them don't do it anymore. People like the very biggies. I mean, I look at all the people I've done lots of shows with, and the way, I mean, I've done, it's ridiculous. People sort of say, how do you get your political perspective? How do you get your musical perspective? Well, the answer is I've lived through it. There's no substitute for having lived through it. I mean, I've done it. And so, I mean, we did the last 2 shows that Bob Marley ever did in Europe. We did the 2 big festivals with him. I played to 167,000 people in East Berlin with James Brown. I mean, we did get shot at with crossbows in Greece and God knows what else. So those things were done. There was a very intense 4 years. But the point is, the music and the creation of music has kept going. And I've also done other things that are much broader. I mean, I've obviously done an Edinburgh show with a play with the last Picasso. I've had a poetry book, which is better known in America than it is here. So I've done lots of things. I don't know. I think regret's not quite the right thing. I just think regret sounds a bit too negative.
Yeah.
What I'm going to do now, though, I mean, as long as I can stay as healthy as possible, I'm going to do lots of the things I didn't do before. I mean, for instance, my personal relationships recently have been a situation whereby I didn't go for something that I really should have done, because I felt I couldn't do that. I didn't want to move to a different country. I didn't want to do that. And I regret not doing that in the short term. But overall, I've been very lucky as a person.
But, you know, life's about learning, though, isn't it? Everything we do, we learn from it, don't we? So, you know.
You do, yeah. But it's nice to learn a bit. And I'd like to have learned what I learned now about 30 years ago. It'd have been really useful. But you learn when you learn, don't you?
I think we could all say that.
Absolutely. So when I'd say, do I regret? No, I don't have any more regrets than anybody else does. I would like to the work that I do to be seen to more as an artist. There's more people. It's not the money. It's not the life standard. It's the fact that if you do something you're quite proud of, you want as many people as possible to hear it.
Yeah, you want recognition.
That. Yeah, you do. Yeah, well, I think we get that from what I get recently. Which is gratifying. People are just amazed at the stories. There's journalists and people, many of the music journalists that have interviewed me from the EU in this last couple of weeks. They've all been in their 40s. So many of them, they weren't alive when the first, but they see it as part of culture. When they talk to me and say, oh my God, we thought you were a new wave, you know, a new wave rock and roll-y type person, and you're not at all. And the interviews have been nothing about music at all. They're about politics, they're about psychology, they're about anything that, you know, that I find really interesting and they find interesting. And I think that, as I say, the music itself should speak for itself. And in the same way as songs and poetry are so different as well. Because, I mean, a poetry, you've got just words. For me, song lyrics shouldn't make much sense on their own. They should only make sense when they merge together with the music as well. So that's a different form.
You said, yeah. I think when you re-recorded the back catalogue, the Fisher's Ed album, you said that the songs don't age, it's just the production of those songs. I think
definitely.
It is about the music and the lyrics in sort of in harmony with each other.
It is that. And what's interesting, we've just done, coming out, we're only selling it on tour. We've got a live record, and I don't like live records normally, but it's a live record done in Hamburg at the end of 2022. It's just amazing for energy, which you don't normally get off the older bands. My band, I mean, none of the band Oh, I only see them very occasionally. I mean, Dave Purdy still plays with me. He lives in Madrid, and so we get together for about 10 minutes before doing a tour. But it's a different experience. I mean, I've had that live band's been together for 6 years. We've held that set up. But I mean, the Triptych record that we just made, that isn't that band. That's my family. That's me, my son-in-law, my daughter, and my mate. But I say the three major themes of the Triptych record are the themes that I've always done. That's why it's Triptych, you know, the psychological, the personal, and the political. So things like a plea. I don't know if you know, I speak Russian. So I saw that letter from a Russian soldier, a young Russian soldier, to his mayor saying, "Don't send any more people to us, to the Ukraine, because all my mates have been killed." And the thing that's, I mean, I've got a lot of military history. I haven't been military, but everybody in my family has. So I understand that really well. And I get that. I talk a lot about that on the European media front.
I hope you get to read this letter. They took away my mobile phone. We've all been told things will get better, but I've been down and I'm all alone. Oh, it's the same old story. Ring out the cliched song. Choked up in hope and glory. Where have all the good guys gone? Where have all the good guys gone? Tell the man.
The artwork's good, isn't it? That's done by a really top photographer. And it's designed by my daughter and son-in-law. They do
quality
film sets for things like Ella McCartney and all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, we do that. But, I mean, the Triptych record is a band record. It sounds like it's songs with a band around it. But, I mean, this year I'm going to do two records. That's the thing that's big difference. I can't get everything I want into it. So you kind of dilute it if you're not careful. So accepting the diversity in the way I think. I've got another record. We're mixing that at the moment, and that's a collaboration with Tony McEnany, who's a genius. He's a producer. He did all sorts of things. He's been in bands. He was my neighbour, but I didn't know him for ages. And he, for instance, did things as diverse. He wrote all the songs and did the TV series with Jimmy Nail for Crocodile Shoes. I mean, that album sold 5 million. It's brilliant songs. And he's not a country songwriter, but he did it. But Tony and I share a big interest. I mean, I don't listen to much, you know, talk about influences. I don't listen to much historic music at all. I mean, your own career is your biggest influence by the time you've done a lot of stuff. But I just want to know what's new all the time. And we listen to that. Structurally, for instance, the Triptych record has got songs in the form that you would expect the songs to be in. The working title for the second one, which will either come in October or very early the following year, that's the Red Flag record. And so that's not about politics. It's about the idea of, you know, red flagging and things being cancelled and all that kind of stuff. It's all about those kind of things. But lyrically and structurally and musically, that's very different. But I just want to produce as much stuff as I can while I'm on form to do so, because I may not want to do it at some stage. Like I'll tour as people say, if you over tour it, people don't want to come and see it. But the Fisher's Ed solo, I mean, I've got a double brand. The Fisher's Ed solo shows are very different from the band ones, because they're in theaters and they're longer, and there's obviously, because I've got auto cue, I can't remember the words, so I've got a thing, like if people come to the cellos, they never know what they're going to see. They could see almost anything virtually. They can request, which they can in some cases if they want to, I can come up with things they won't believe they'd never seen before. On the last solo tour, I did the complete Red Skies record on my own, and that's never been done before. And so people were really amazed by that. And I think I'm going to theme the next tour. I'll do the new stuff, but I'll also do with this Fisher's Ed solo show. When I say solo, it's just me, but it's very noisy and occasionally has guests at the end. But I'm going to do the complete Going Deaf, I think, album stuff. And that's never been done before.
No.
And so that's interesting.
Do you have a preference for, you know, solo or band, or is that?
Yeah, I prefer to play solo.
Do you?
Yeah, because I've done the band thing for so long. I love the thing with a band, and I love playing the thing with a band. And it's a nice, it's a good, it's really easy. I've never been a great team player, and so therefore, the solo thing is really dangerous. It's because you're not just you're not a perform musician. You have to be an entertainer. You've got to be on it. You've got to be so on it. I mean, it's a totally individual thing. If you, for instance, I did a lot of gigs with Sam Walker. We were two piece. That the best band format by a mile is two piece, because the two of you can be in perfect tune, and that's wonderful. And when I did this stuff, the big poetry stuff with Ingo, that was me playing acoustic guitar with going through ridiculous effects, screaming like crazy, and Ingo doing four decks. I mean, that was just outrageous.
I woke up gargling rusty nails. I was positively down. I was hanging onto a tiger's tail. I was positively down. I ran my tongue around my mouth. I thought of it. I weighed myself and I felt like shit. Anesthetized on the booze a bit. I couldn't take the pressure of it. I woke up depressed. I got dressed. I'm obsessed. Such a tight mess. Hocus pocus, lose my focus. Running out of things to do on purpose. Sense of reason, sense of rhyme. Instead of making money, there is purpose to my poetry. Big beat poetry is big. Big beat poetry is big.
I like things to be dangerous. I like performance stuff that goes wrong. Because in the same principle as jazz, the most interesting stuff is stuff that comes out of mistakes. And the band, I like the band stuff. Don't get me wrong, but it's the solo shows is whoa, it really is stretching. And I think all the best many great things, but all the best creative work, you've got to move outside your comfort zone, and then you find out things about yourself. Also, all the songs I've ever written work in some form of solo forms. I adore it. And that's not to knock the band thing at all, but the idea of being able to experiment in form. I mean, the whole idea of art's about an expression of the world, isn't it? It's about your view of the world. I tend to do it through words and through music. It's got to be it's hopefully a very individual thing. It's nice if it's a unique thing. It's got to be very sincere. But if you're lucky, it gains a certain universality and everybody else appreciates it. I mean, you make music for yourself. You have to do that, because if you don't love it, if you're not into it, there's no point, you know? And I've always been quoted, it sounds arrogant, but it's not. And it's the idea that I'll play what the audience deserve, not what they want. But what they deserve is great performance. That's all you have. That's your obligation as an artist.
Yeah, when we talked to other bands, actually, interestingly enough, they were in a worse position because they were being made by their record companies to make music that the record company wanted that they didn't want to make.
Right.
So it's even worse for them. It's like that. Yeah. And actually, pretty much every band we spoke to with that same story pretty much broke the band, you know, totally.
You mean broke the band up or broke them into the
You know, so it was the start of the end for them, because it's created like a conflict, and it was like they've gone against their values and their principles. And, you know, it just kind of like, this didn't want to, it's not what they wanted to do anymore, you know?
Sure. So, I was much too pig-headed. Nobody ever told me what to do. And I moved on. I've had seven major record deals because they think it's good, but you know, I just can't do that. Well, I think you stick to what you believe in. I mean, I have done artistically. I've compromised business stuff, but I've never compromised any artistic stuff.
From a songwriting perspective then, do you think your songwriting has changed over the last sort of 30, 40 years? Or do you do it the same way? Or
I'd go back to the same thing, saying that my art form is writing music and writing words. And so therefore, as I've changed over a period of time, if you like, the way of writing and the subject matter and everything changes with it. It's a view of the world thing, I think. Because I was a drummer to start with. I'm much more interested in rhythms and dance music again than most. So therefore, that doing things like the Big Beat Poetry record, which was hip hop and poetry, is not so far away from where I come. I mean, when I was playing drums, I suddenly realized that when the hip hop beats came out, it was Rare Groove turn round. That's all. It was a Rare Groove beat turn round, and I played Rare Groove as a drummer. So, you know, and I'm just really interested by, you're influenced by what's contemporary you learn from what's contemporary. So to answer your earlier question, Martin, the idea that you're also influenced by contemporary stuff and that feeds in. The thing that's a shame is that a lot of the young bands, there's a lot of great talent that'll never be seen. If they can't navigate a social media world, they might be brilliant, but if they can't manage to help push themselves out there, they won't get out there anymore. There's no development in young bands. A record company will only develop a very small number of very big acts. I mean, there's a policy with companies. They won't sign anything that they don't think will sell 250,000 records. And that's monstrous numbers these days.
One of the other areas that when we've spoken to bands about was going back a bit, was the impact that John Peel had on their
yeah,
careers. And obviously
definitely.
You had some of that, didn't you? With
he liked Remember Russia.
Remember yeah, Russia, yeah.
But
yeah.
Then he hated it because we got so big, he didn't like that. When we did Red Skies Over Paradise, I remember him, he came and saw us doing that.
Said, most of London's gone. You saw the cloud rise from here. An ice cream van with its music on goes round and round. Out in the park, children were playing. Glowed red. People were stunned. Everyone waiting. Nobody knew why. But they know it all now. Down in the bunkers, under the sea, men pressing buttons.
I think he thought we'd got out of his realm of doodah because we went from nothing to playing to 20,000 people in about 3 months. Do you see what I mean? He felt we didn't need the help.
Yeah, I get that.
And he thought that I was quite careerist because at that stage, it was not the done thing to entertain. Everybody had to be quite, didn't they? Everybody was supposed to be really cool and sneery. And I entertained and there was humour and people. I mean, we played Reading Festival in 1980 and the band before us, who was it? The bloke who used to be in the Dan. Brian James, the Helions, they got canned off. He got knocked virtually unconscious with potatoes and God knows what else. We went on after them. So it's basically, it was quite a big biker audience. I remember it clearly. I got slagged in the press for it. I went on and just explained the difference between my head and a microphone. And we did it at a great gig. I was very rude to the people. It went fantastically well, but that was seen as being pandering to an audience at that stage. That's 1980. Nowadays, pop stars are given more training in entertainment and movement than they are in music. How to entertain. Mind you, it's a bit formularized.
Yes.
I like chaos.
Yeah, you know, Reading back in the day, it was kind of a biker festival, wasn't it? Until sort of mid-80s, really, when it
Definitely.
Started to get different bands in there. So, yeah.
Well, we played Wacken about 3 years ago. We played Wacken in Germany, which is the biggest metal festival in the world.
Right.
What you did there is you pick your set a bit. But I played it more like, yeah, more like a punk set. And it
right,
was
yeah.
astounding. And then you can still play a ballad in the middle. And metal audiences are actually very, generally very nice people. Like metal bands, the nicest bands in the world. They're really nice guys, generally. They look wildest, but they're the nicest ones.
Yes, yeah.
I don't know if your experience is the same. Mine's certainly not. The idea of a big festival, it's really funny because people will come on and shout down a microphone. You don't need to shout because it's all very loud. If you're playing a big, if you're playing at 20,000 people plus, then the art is to make the bloke who's by the burger stand, everybody feel that you're actually performing to them. And when you play a small venue, it's the opposite. You've got to make people feel that they're part of an event that's very important. Before doing festivals, I'll walk around the outside and see what it looks like to watch the band from the burger stall, see what it looks like to watch the band from the beer tent, see what it looks like. So therefore, I'm very aware of what's going on. I like some of the shows I particularly like. I mean, there's some of these sort of mini, it's not a festival really, and that sort of outdoor event, maybe about 2,000 people, some of the natural sort of amphitheaters and things like that. I like playing those. With the solo stuff, they automatically assume to start with I needed a seated audience because I talk a lot, but normally half, now it's sort of half seated for the solo shows. But again, I'm doing standing shows in Holland with a proviso that for the first bit of the set, which is a bit quieter, They don't have a bar open for the first half an hour. Then as it hots up, they do that. Then there's a break and it becomes more of a rock event as time goes on. So you gauge. But what I don't like is little. Everybody says they love dirty, smelly, dark rock clubs. That's the ideal thing to play. Not my thing. I prefer it when I can see more people and I can perform to more people rather than just kind of make a noise in the corner.
So some of your songs like So Long and Marley's and so on, they seem to have been what I would consider to be a bit timeless. You know,
because
it's
really funny.
You still play those.
Weird thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But and there's other songs that you probably haven't played for some time.
Mm. The thing is that the great thing about the Fisher Z stuff is when you go and see people even much bigger than us, and I did several things recently with Simple Minds, people recognize the big hits. They recognize about four of the songs, which are huge. And often they have difficulty. They just don't hold in between. My stuff, I've never had anything that's that big, but I've got so many things that people know well. When we play our sets in England as well, actually, but specifically the EU sets. I mean, if you've done that as many albums as I have, and you're doing potentially the best song from, I could play, the band would blow their minds. I could play three different sets, three nights running, and 25 songs and doing different ones, and people would know them. And that's most unusual. So they're not hits, but they're well known. I mean, the Red Skies album in Germany, people know actually all of it really well. And they sing it all and they do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I saw you in Berlin in the Columbia Theatre pre-COVID. Yeah, I came over and that was
a goodie.
I was going to ask you whether or not you still keep in contact with any of the original.
Oh, yeah, I do. I do keep in touch with Steve. I mean, he's quite a lot older than me. Steve Little, the drummer, I like Steve a lot. He's in Bristol. I mean, he became an antiquarian book dealer. Wow. He came down to join a punk band, to join Fisher Z, which wasn't a punk band, really. And for instance, he liked all the thing about punk, but you'd find him reading Nietzsche and playing chess and doing stuff like that. He's a great guy. I mean, I don't have anything to do with Dave Graham, the original bass player.
Right, because you did the garden party video.
That was funny.
I brought
everybody together. It was a very nasty thing to do to them. The thing I tried to do that. And if you saw the DVD, but I interviewed it. I said something lovely about everybody sitting in a bath of bubble. It was an experience in the sense of performance theatre. I mean, if you saw Fisher Z in the 90s, at one stage we got so into performance theatre that we never did very much music. I mean, we did something really weird before everything. When Nick Bunker, Haji Wasner, was in the band, he encouraged my... I was already always wanting to break the mould and do something antisocial, but he encouraged it to the point where it got ridiculous. When we did Destination Paradise, which was a good record, and we did a Real World and Peter Gabriel sung on it.
Oh, my fingers won't tap. Stay still in my lap. I'm glued to the box. To the speeches and fireworks, get up off of that kitchen floor. I don't know what you're crying for. Get up out of that comfy chair. I can't take you anywhere. I'm your strong defender with a heart of ice. I've got no illusions, but what I do is right. And so it's Destination Paradise for you and I. Oh, the windows are closed, so nobody knows. It's raining out there on the poor and the powerless. Get up off of that comfy floor. I don't know what you're crying for. Get up out of that comfy chair. I can't take you anywhere. I'm a strong defender with a heart of ice. I've got no illusions, but what I do is right. So it's destination.
With that, we look so weird. I now understand why they couldn't take it seriously.
Obviously, because those first three albums, obviously it culminated in your decision to sort of stop and then do the John Watts solo. Do you look back now? I know I'm not going to talk about regrets, but do you look back with any sort of fonder memories of that time, of those three albums, of that?
I've got fond memories of all the time. Yeah, sure. I mean, but that's that to all the different eras, really. But yes, certainly. I mean, the thing is, it's very exciting when it's all new. You're only new once.
So if you had a favourite memory, what would that be?
What, from that era?
Well, both. So
lots. I mean, I've been talking to, there's a guy called Jim Irvin, who is the editor of Mojo. He's a friend of mine socially.
Yeah.
And he's going to write, which we haven't done with me. He says that there hasn't been a proper English journalist appraisal of what I'm actually up to.
No.
So there's a lot comes in from abroad, but when it's translated, it doesn't work the same way. And he knew something about me, but not much. He's quite surprised. He got me to put 12 stories forward of things, really unusual things that had happened. We were seen as being very thoughtful and, you know, we had the image of being thoughtful and intellectual and strange. We actually had, the Stranglers were concerned about us. They were scared of us. They didn't think I was a psychologist. They thought I was a psychopath, because we'd had the first big gig we did in Germany. I had a huge battle off stage with mad screaming drug claims lunatics, a big battle and a fight. We were arrested in Norway. I was arrested in Austria. People didn't know anything about that at all within a period of about 4 years. And so I thought, I mean, I was a kid. I said I wanted to do sport or music, and I was a rugby player, a rugby fullback. I did boxing and I did all sorts of stuff. So anything that was a bit leery, I quite enjoyed that. That was a good thing about the punk and new wave era. But then you get funny things. I think one fond memory must be playing, for instance, when we got signed, everybody said we got signed to UA, and everybody, and I saw a review of the gig. We had an amazing review that day. Then we got signed by UA. The amazing review, it was in Swansea, I think. It was in Wales. There was only about three people in the gig. And the bar staff, and we were good, and that was signed. But the funniest thing, which you don't get anymore, I mean, when you used to play originally in London, you'd get, like, the support band could be a woman juggling a snake, which you don't get anymore. And my favourite one, no, I think a favourite funny memory of that era, when they used to dealing with punk bands, I think it was the Newbridge Club and Institute in Wales, and the stage was like playing on a windowsill. But the funniest thing was, they wanted us to play two sets, so we played the first set. And the bloke came up to me, the club bloke, said, "Oh, very good, very good." He said, "Do you mind?" He said, "We now have the bingo." I said, "Okay." He said, "Do you mind calling the bingo?" I said, no, that. So the idea of playing a high-energy, new wave, punky set, then being a bingo caller for 20 minutes, and then going back and doing the second set, that wouldn't happen now.
That's incredible.
I would challenge Harry Styles to make a good job of that.
So because of your catalogue is so huge, how do you pick what songs to play in both your solo sets and your band sets?
Some of the later albums were quite big. So things like the Destination Paradise record was bigger selling than you'd expect it to be. The Reveal record was quite big selling. But I mean, for instance, the best guitar record we ever made was 13 Stories High.
Great album.
I love that record. I mean, you can do some things from that. I'm trying to think what now. I do Angel of Gardenia from there sometimes.
Jennifer's an angel in a clothing store. There was a fragrance. I know there was an angel present. Something like Gardenia would be there every time I'd seen her. She kept her wings undercover. Maybe she saved it for her lover's eyes. Only for her lover's eyes. Callahan was a builder from the site next door. He was overpowered the moment that he smelled the flowers. Something like Gardenia would be there every time he'd seen her. She kept her wings undercover. Maybe she saved it for her lover's eyes. Only for her lover's eyes. Don't tell me I'm in love for the first time.
And Kamikaze Shirt seems to be the album that doesn't seem to get mined much for things.
No, that's right. But I always thought it was a weaker album, but there are lots of things I do from that now. Yeah, I do Blue Anemone. But the thing is, Human Beings is a huge, a very, very popular live song from Fishers. It's massive.
Keeping off the flies, swollen stomach, swollen head, and sad and swollen eyes. Waiting for the charity that slowly dribbles in. This little boy's relying on the color of your skin. We did it for the jaguars, the pandas and the seals, and save protected species with our desperate appeals. We did it for the elephants and monkeys in a sack, and just like you, we lost a few. They're never coming back.
Why
not human beings?
We do it more, a bit slower. And there's something from, you see, even from that record, because I always thought that was a bit of a, do you know what, that cover's got an interesting story to it. We were working on a certain cover, right? We worked on a cover, on a cover for a long time. Then I didn't like it. So I just went onto a computer and found a background wallpaper of anything. And that's what it is. It was chosen in 2 minutes. And I thought, right. Well, stick that.
I was going to ask you about your covers.
No meaning whatsoever on that one.
No,
at all,
okay.
It was dredged up. But the other covers, there's a lot of thought going into different bits and pieces. I mean, Swimming in Thunderstorms and then Till the Oceans Overflow was the idea of things building up. And then, obviously, lots of things changed at that point in COVID and God knows what else.
I've got one last question, if that's okay, which is about... So it's about the Till the Oceans Overflow. So you've got... Yeah. That was like the follow... Sort of like you pitched it as like the follow-up to Red Skies. Is that right?
It had something in common with it, yeah. I mean, the imagery of having the same man on the front.
Yeah.
Yeah, Till the Oceans Overflow. I mean, it was the idea of a build-up. In the same point as Red Skies was built, everybody was... Well, I wasn't. A lot of people were frightened that there was going to be a nuclear war in Europe. And here, the time Till the Oceans came, everybody thought we were all building up to this kind of green problem and refugees. It's building up to a different kind of crisis. Ironically, it was COVID that was the crisis at the time. So that it was building up. The oceans overflowed. That was just about it. It illustrated all the weaknesses in modern society throughout the world, really. Demonstrated, and given the fact the two worst things in the... I think I probably said it already today, but the two things that cause all the problems for people and for races and everything in the world of fear and loneliness, everything comes from that. It's a funny world. I'm into the ritual and the reality of things. Also, the disappearance of facts and truth in politics is difficult, because I mean, a politician can legitimately now go on television and say, yeah, we lied, which you never could have done 5 years ago. That's partly legacy from people like Trump.
I mean, you have an incredible legacy, so in the music that you've made, so which is fantastic. But thank you so much for what you've shared today. It's been fascinating. A great story.
No, you ask great questions, so it makes it easy. I think, I mean, I like to be able to say what I do and what I am, because the music covers the rest of it, really.
No, it's really brilliant. Thank you.
No, you're welcome. Thank you, both of you. It's excellent stuff.
Young man, Germany, lots of sensitivities. Since the girl of his dream, sure that eternity's far too long to wait for the perfect day. Too long to wait for the perfect day. A young girl, 17, who knows what she could have been, needs a flat, a
urgently for her child. Eternity's far too long to wait for the perfect day. Far too long to wait for the perfect day.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. As you know, we do our research from a variety of sources. But of course, if you want to add any more details to what we've talked about, then you can, of course, contact us. Where can they contact us, Noel?
Well, they can contact us on our email address, which is podcast@uncharted80s.com.
Brilliant. Or you can do that via our Facebook group, The Uncharted 80s. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.